I don't know if you remember this, but you once used Mel Blanc's great punchline for a conversation we had. It happened years ago, about 25 years ago. I had some extra money, and my accountant told me that I should make a charitable donation of some amount. And so I chose to give $5,000 to the Los Angeles Zoo so they could buy a Tasmanian devil. You know, they were buying a breeding pair of Tasmanian devils, which ultimately never bred, but they brought them to the United States anyway. So the price for one Tasmanian devil was $5,000. And I was talking to you about that, and you said, what does a Tasmanian devil go for? And I said, $5,000. And he said, Mark said, I could have got you Mel Blanc for $700.
No, you know, the funny thing is, you couldn't have, but the joke is funnier that way.
Yeah. I know, you probably would have been double that at least.
Oh, more than that. But
anyway. No, I'm
$5,000. Welcome to Radio Rashi, Almost Live with Paul and Misty. I am Paul Dini.
I'm Misty Lee, and we have a special guest. This is part two.
Our wonderful guest, Mark Evanier.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I've been sitting here now for a week waiting to do the second part. Why can't you just tape one after another?
Yeah, well, you know what?
That's an interesting
because
idea.
We've got a whole piece of pizza to consume.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, we split an entire piece of pizza.
And people expect it to be live.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, almost live at least, right? Yes.
Breaking the illusion.
Wait, so it's not live.
Yeah. What? You mean I'm not over there right now?
Yeah.
How many panels are you doing at Comic-Con, Mark?
All of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
How many panels aren't you doing?
I think my current total, which will probably scale back at the moment, the list has 16 on it.
Oh my god.
Yikes.
Wow. Which is only four a day. But I think we'll probably drop a few of them off. I'll probably end up doing about 14.
Oh gee. You know.
And only two of them will be scheduled at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then during that, he'll write a 130-page script, 2 half-hour specials of something else, and 3 issues of a comic book.
Well,
right?
As I was saying earlier, it's very easy to do a lot of stuff if you just drop all pretenses of quality.
Oh, stop.
I live by that rule. Are you looking forward to this year's Comic-Con?
I always look forward to this year's Comic-Con. I look forward to next year's Comic-Con. I have a great time at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
How old were you when you went to your first Comic-Con?
Well, it was 1970, so I was...
Five.
I was 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and how did you learn about... I mean, had you always read comic books? How did you
I read comic books my entire life. I tell people that when I was delivered and the doctor slapped me, I dropped a copy of Walt Disney's Comics and Stories. I have always read comic books.
Yeah.
I have
all duck doodles in the womb.
Yeah, I just and here's another one of those phrases.
Kate paintings inside Mark's mom.
I have always had more comic books than you.
Yeah.
No matter who you are, no matter how many you have, I have more than you do.
I can attest to this. Yes.
I'm using that.
So
doesn't matter who you are.
That's right.
So you went to your first Comic-Con at 18. What was that like?
My first Comic-Con I actually went to was in New York.
Uh-huh.
I went to the July 4th convention in 1970 at the Statler Hilton. And it was an amazing weekend. My then partner, Steve Sherman, and I flew to New York. And we went to DC and to Marvel and to MAD. And we met everybody whose work I'd ever admired. I'll tell you, here's one of those stories.
I love them.
My life abounds in these stories.
I love them.
The first day we were in New York, we were Jack Kirby's assistants. We went to DC. The second day we were supposed to go over to Marvel, we were working for the Marvel fan club at the time also, and we were supposed to have a meeting with Stan Lee at 11 a.m.
Who's that guy?
Yeah, so that was how I was going to meet Stan for the first time. So Steve and I get all dressed, we get ready to go over there. Just as we're ready to leave the hotel, they call and say, Stan's got a meeting, he's got to postpone, he'll see you at 2.
Okay.
So we're ready to go out, we have no place to go, so we decided, let's go to Madison Avenue, we'll walk up and down the street, look around, and find a place to get lunch, and we'll just sightsee. So we walk over to Madison Avenue, which is the street Marvel was on, and we walk up down Madison, and we stop at a corner for a light. You could tell we were from Los Angeles, so we actually stopped for lights in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I suddenly hear my voice. I hear somebody yell, "Hey, my friend!" And I look over, and it's Sergio Aragonés is across the street.
What?
And And I'd only met Sergio once or twice in L.A. by then. I was surprised he remembered me at all, let alone saw me across the boulevard and recognized me. We walked over. And he's, my friend's from Los Angeles. And he's so excited. And he says, what are you doing? I said, well, we're going to go meet Stan Lee. And he says, oh, that's great. He says, you're going to visit the man offices? And I said, well, we hadn't planned on it. He says, I'll give you a tour. We were standing in front of the Mad offices. He was just on his way in when he spotted us.
So
he took us to the Mad offices, and we walked in, and as I was walking in, this little sad-faced man was walking out with an art portfolio. And I said to Sergio, who's that? He says, that's Wally Wood. We were at the Mad offices. We met the whole, not the whole staff of Mad, but all the people who worked in the office and a lot of freelancers who were in. And then we went down the street and met Stan Lee that day. It was a very heady day for people who are into comics. And then at the convention, a couple of days later at the Statler Hilton, I met almost everybody else in comics who I hadn't met those 2 days at DC and Marvel.
Unbelievable. Wow. Now, when we were chewing our pizza this week, we were looking at photographs on your iPad that you had loaded on there. And one of them was of yourself.
Charlie Kochman on the left, Al Jaffe in the center, and me on the right. And I said, the great part of that photo is you can fold it in and make Al Jaffe disappear. So,
Al Jaffe, you did one of the great books on magic, too. Funny books on magic. It's terrific.
Anyway, my life abounds in great coincidences of being in the right place at the right time. And
speaking of which, you were showing me a photograph also of something I was super jealous of. You got to feed some pumpkins to some hippos at the zoo.
Yes, this is true. Yes.
Oh, it makes me so, I'm green, almost as green as the lettuce you also got to feed, the pumpkins.
Yes, we fed
the hippos. The pumpkins didn't eat the lettuce, right? The hippos did?
No.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to stop talking and let you continue.
Well, Mark, I have to thank you for one of the great fan experiences of my life, which was, I went to my first San Diego Con at 75. I didn't know anybody. And I don't think I went back to like about 1980 or 81. And by then I had been working a little bit in the business. And I think around that time you were hosting sort of like the afternoon after parties at your house.
It was the evening. It was Sunday evening, yeah.
That's right.
The convention would not end. It would just move to my house.
Yeah. And I remember being invited over, and this was like my, fanboy, Valhalla, because I'm invited over to Mark Evanier's house. He's having pizza, and he's having everybody in comics over there, everybody from the convention. And I just remember Sergio playing pinball with Wendy Peeney. You had a pinball machine, and Wendy was laughing at something so hard she fell down on the floor. And
yeah, she does that.
Yeah. And I just walked in there, and I was like, man, everybody cool from the convention is here. Yeah. And they somehow let me in. This is awesome.
Now, Mark, how did you become the ambassador of Comic-Con? Because you are, there is no one. Not only do you have more comic books than anyone else, but you also do more panels, as we were saying, at Comic-Con than anyone else.
Well, I do panels because I enjoy it and because it gives me something to do. It gives me a place to be at the convention. I go to comic conventions because I want to see my friends. Mm-hmm. But then what happens either is they park you behind a table and you sit there and sign your name all day, mm-hmm. which kind of bores me. Or you walk around and your feet start to hurt. And so when I started hosting panels, I went, oh, now I've got a place to be. I tell people, when you can't move around the dealer's room Saturday afternoon, I've got a whole room to myself upstairs
where
I interview people. So, it's fun. I like the program items at conventions. I always like going to conventions, and if there's gonna be an interview with some great comic book artist, I'd rather do it myself. So that therefore the interview contains the questions that I want answered.
Yeah, there you go. Now, speaking of that, I want to ask you something because Quick Draw is one of my favorite. I think it's the very first panel that I ever saw at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And also, just very quickly, I want to thank you for giving me the best advice about Comic-Con I've ever received, which was wear comfortable shoes.
Oh, yes.
You told me that the first time I met you, I think, was at Paul's
Steel
party, and then at WonderCon was the first time I saw you again.
That's right.
And I heeded your advice, and I have been grateful to you ever since. Every year, every time I set foot on the Comic-Con floor, I think of you.
I think you would have figured that out without me, actually, after a year or two. But
you saved me a lot of barking dog time, because right. That would have been horrid. Hitting that floor in heels, it's just unacceptable.
Saturday afternoon.
It was years before I learned to leave the heels home.
Yeah.
I was wearing these 4-inch pumps. That was terrible.
Or just have someone else wear them for
That's
you.
Right. Yes.
Saturday afternoon is when all the poor little cosplayers heels start going out, and they kind of litter the the roads around San Diego. They've just passed out and are left to die where they fall off their heels.
It's like a Dark Side attack.
What's that?
So it looks like Dark Side attacked, and all the superheroes are just lying there on the ground.
It's kind of
our version of the Rapture.
So there we go.
All these empty Sailor Moon costumes.
So what I was trying to ask you before I sidetracked myself was, how did Quick Draw come to be?
Oddly enough,
should we tell them what that is?
Quick Draw, you can tell them what it is.
No, you can.
All right. Quick Draw is a game we play at the convention every year where we have three very fast cartoonists on stage. One of whom is usually Sergio Aragonés. One of whom is usually Scott Shaw. And we have a guest player each year. And then I'm out in the audience with a hand mic. The artists are at tables, drawing tables where they have projectors so you can see what they're drawing as they're drawing it. And I am out in the audience picking up suggestions and ideas. And what I did was I adapted improv games, comedy improv games, for cartoonists. I tell people it's a lot like the TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway, except that instead of actors, they're cartoonists. And instead of having it all written in advance, they make it up. I made up these different games we play every year. And people seem to like the thing. The way it came about was that a fellow named Gary Sassaman, who is one of the programming, he's been promoted from this, but he used to be one of the programming directors at the convention, came to me one time and said, you know, people have suggested we have some sort of a game with cartoonists. Could you come up with something? And I think he even the one who named it Quick Draw.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And we started doing it, and it caught on. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, the fastest to fill panel in the convention that doesn't feature some, you know, mega movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And
you have thousands of people come to these things. I mean, we have been in a room, and it's hard to see even the overhead projector because it is so well populated.
Yeah, well, we're trying to work on that, but
it wasn't a complaint.
It's just
impressive.
Yeah, it's
and it's really fun.
It's a lot of fun to do, and you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to, you know, play Phil Donahue or you know, Oprah, whatever it is. I'm interviewing the audience and asking, getting suggestions from them, and it's fun.
And somehow I always stick Peter David. Like you always give me something to do, and it always gets palmed off on Peter David.
Well, one year we had this game we play called Secret Words.
Yes.
And I pick someone. I get a friend of mine up, and he has to guess three words. So I was going to have Paul do it, and the words are in an envelope for each person's words, and the envelope said PD on it for Paul Dini, and Paul didn't show up that year, but I had the envelope, and I saw Peter David sitting out there, and I went, I've got the envelope, already has the right initials on it, so I dragged Peter David up there, and
quite a surprise for him.
Yes. And Peter was a very good player of the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has been a frequent flyer with the Quick Draw program.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
He's very proud. And every time he gets up and has such a great time, he sits down and says to Paul, could have been you, but you didn't show up every single year.
Yeah.
Every year. Because he always finds us. We always find him at the Quick Draw panel. Peter David, who went in costume this year to the
WonderCon.
At WonderCon.
Yeah, WonderCon. There's this guy walking around in a Green Hornet costume. Uh-huh. And we didn't know who it was. He was just this one little schlumpy guy, and it turned out that Peter David was attending the convention, who had not been advertised, and he was making an appearance on a panel, I think on Saturday or Sunday. He didn't want to sit in his room, but he also didn't want people to see him before he made the surprise appearance on the Saturday panel. So he got himself a Green Hornet costume when he went to panels.
Wow.
And he talked to me. I didn't know who it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, very familiarly.
Yes, and he'd come up and he did the same to me. I kind of broke it in the last minute, but he had me going for a long time.
He said Paul Levitz had no idea who he was. We had dinner with him a couple weeks ago, and he said he spoke to Paul Levitz, and they were talking about stuff, and Paul was speaking so candidly about a ton of projects, and Peter said, well, it's nice to see you, Paul. And Paul said, and blew him off. And Peter said,
makes you think maybe Clark Kent could get away with it.
There you go. Yeah.
I think Peter is actually now working toward fighting crime actively. Like, he's gone home, okay, it worked. Now I'm going to patrol New York or Patchogue, Long Island, looking for crime, which... I'm not sure if they have much of it there.
So, do you have a favorite or a few favorite Comic-Con moments from all the years that you've been there?
My favorite moment of any Comic-Con I've been at was probably one year We brought a gentleman named John Broome to the convention.
Okay.
John Broome was a comic book artist, a comic book writer who wrote for years and years and years, and he was most notable for having written the Silver Age Flash, Silver Age Batman, Silver Age Green Lantern.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably the best one of those guys.
Oh, yeah.
And he had never been to a comic convention in his life. He was living in Japan and France. He was commuting. He'd spend 6 months of the year in France, 6 months in Japan, and neither time would be convenient to get him to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
There was a comic fan named Richard Morrissey, who unfortunately has since passed away, a sweet little guy who was dying to meet John Broome and who wanted to reunite John Broome with his longtime editor, Julius Schwartz, because they were best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
They hadn't seen each other in 20 years or something like that. And Richard Morrissey suddenly called me up one day and he said, John Broome has to go from Japan to Paris during the Comic-Con. He's going to be stopping off in L.A.
Oh, my gosh.
He has a layover. For $1,200, we can have him come down to Comic-Con because he's already got his airfare paid for the trip. It'll cost $1,200 extra to bring him to Comic-Con. I went to the convention, and they said, we'll give him a free room, but our travel budget will not allow this. So Richard called a bunch of us, and everybody put in $100-$200, and we brought John Broome to the convention. The moment that was kind of magical, first of all, everybody was so thrilled to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
We did this panel. We had Julie Schwartz on the panel, along with Murphy Anderson, who drew many of his scripts, and a fellow named Mike Barr, a writer who was mm-hmm. a fan of his. And we had this packed room of people to hear the master John Broome talk. And at one point, just on a whim, I said, how many people in this room have written comic books professionally? Because people who write comic books generally do not go to panels.
Right. Right.
Everybody in the room put up their hand.
Oh,
wow. Were you in that room, Paul?
No.
And it was like this gasp where everybody realized that the industry had turned out. It was all people who'd written comics there. And John was
kind of gave me, that gave
me
chills.
And John understood that what this meant and was thrilled by it. And he passed away about four to six months after the convention.
Wow. Oh, now that really gave me chills.
And it was I was so happy we got him there.
Yeah.
Another moment, there's a fellow named Dave Siegel, who's a friend of ours. Dave drives a cab in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah?
And he's an enormous fan of... And here's one of those coincidences, my life abounds. And the year before, I went to the licensing show in Las Vegas. I get off the plane. I walk out with my suitcase to the cab stand. In Vegas, they tell you, a dispatcher says, oh, you take space 12. You go to mm-hmm. space 12, and you get in whatever cab is in space 12. You don't pick your own cab.
Right.
It was Dave Siegel's cab.
Oh, my. What?
There are 4,000 cab drivers in Las Vegas.
At least.
I got the one I knew. So anyway. But Dave is a fan of old comic book artists. The older, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been the champion of tracking these guys down when they're out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, one day he called me up, he said, whatever happened to Chuck Quidera, who drew the original Blackhawk? I said, I don't know. I've heard he was in Florida someplace, but he hasn't been involved in comics in 30 years. DC Comics has money for him for reprints. They don't know where to send it. I hung up with Dave. He called back 2 hours later and said, just got off the phone with Chuck Quidera. I found him. And we brought Chuck Quidera to the convention the next year and gave him an award, and he got to see his old friends.
And he
got about $8,000 from DC Comics.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Nice.
So one year, Dave found a fellow named Fred Gardiner, who created Zatara the Magician in the 1940s, mm-hmm. and who had not been around comics since about the early 50s. He got out of comics. Nobody knew where he was. Nobody had any contact with him. Dave found him in a nursing home in Northern California, brought him down to the convention. I think Dave may have paid his way down there himself.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And we had Fred Gardiner at this, and Fred was in a wheelchair. And the convention has a thing called the Inkpot Award they give out.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me Fred's Inkpot Award to give him at the Golden Age panel, which I was moderating. And Fred's in the wheelchair, and I announced we were presenting him the Inkpot Award, and the audience started cheering, of course. And Fred started to get up, and I whispered to him, you don't have to get up. He whispered to me, this is the first award I ever got in my life. I'm standing up for it.
Oh, my God.
So he stood up, and I held him. I had to hold him up in the back. I was holding the back of his pants so he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And he made this wonderful, moving speech. I looked out, and his wife and his kids were sitting out in the front crying. They were so happy. It was like the high moment of his life. And Fred got this award. And we also have on that panel a man named Vince Sullivan, who was the editor of Action Comics number 1, the first Superman.
Oh, wow.
And after the panel was over, maybe before the panel, somebody came up to me, I forget who it was, it may have been Mike Catron, and said, you know, Mark, we have this convention, everybody who's alive who worked on Action Comics number 1 is here.
Oh, my God.
There were four people there.
Wow.
Sheldon Moldoff was also there. And then Joanne Siegel, the widow of Jerry Siegel, was there. She was the fourth person. And also, it turned out Joe Shuster's sister was there.
Wow.
And we put together a last-minute panel. It wasn't even on the schedule. I went to the convention and said, give me another room.
Yeah.
I'm adding a panel. And we did an Action Comics number 1 panel with everybody alive who had any hand in Action Comics number 1. And boy, that was a memorable moment. Just to have all that history right in front of us there.
That's unbelievable.
Those are the moments that, you know, where Comic-Con really lives for me, you know, like when things that special happen, quite often on the spur of the moment, or, you know, they just sort of snowball from one good idea into something tremendous.
Yeah. I'll tell you a beef I have with some people who go to Comic-Con. We did a panel, I think it was not last year, the year before. We had every surviving Bob Kane ghost artist. We had Jerry Robinson, Sheldon Moldoff, I can't remember all the names. There was four guys who had all worked for Bob Kane. We had them together for the first time, talking about their days of working on Batman and things like that. It was a wonderful panel. I go downstairs shortly afterwards, and somebody comes up to me, some guy, and he says, oh, God, I hate this convention. Nothing here is about comics. It's all about movies. I said,
I just did
a panel with the four most important Batman artists who are alive. Where the hell were you?
Yeah.
He says, I didn't know about it. Well, it's in the program book.
Take a look.
There's stuff here about comics. You don't take 10 minutes, go on the internet and read the schedule.
Yes.
It's there.
Stop stabbing each other in Hall H.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to spend the entire time this year, but somebody invited me to be on a panel about Christmas comics. He has a comic out this year that has a Christmas theme, and he just thought it would be fun to put together, you know, a Christmas theme panel. And it's like, sure, I'm up for that. You know, why not? You know, he gets to promote his book. I'll promote, you know, Jingle Bell and everything. But it's also, let's make this into something. Let's look back at rather than just pimp our own stuff, let's look back at some, you know, great stuff that, you know, was in the past too. Talk about this. Because it should be more than just, you know, movies and, you know, coming in.
Oh, and the other punchline, the guy was, when I pointed out the guy had missed this panel with the Batman guys, he said, well, I had to get in line for the Lost panel. He's complaining there isn't enough about comics there, but he's got to see the Lost
panel. I would have passed up the Lost panel. Do that.
Yeah. And you were on it.
I was on it, yeah. But,
those times like that makes me wish I had a gun with rubber bullets in it and could just pop somebody and just knock them out for a minute, not kill them, you know, just so that they wake up rubbing their temple and going, wow, I must have done something.
Well, the secret to this is like, look at the programs in advance and just, you know, cut the dealer's room some slack. You know, that's where all the madness is like trying to get by the Mattel booth or the Nickelodeon booth and stuff like that.
You know, the first time I ever went to Disneyland, I had a miserable time. I didn't plan anything. I didn't read up in advance. I didn't look at a map. I just went. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know when things started. I had a terrible time.
Mm-hmm.
When I went back to Disneyland, I looked at a guidebook first. I learned where things were. I decided what I wanted to see. I had a great time. It's that way with Comic-Con.
Yeah.
You got to do a little prep. It's too big to just stumble into it and hope you run into the part that'll interest you.
Yeah.
And it's selling out like a year in advance now.
Yes.
Oh, no, it sold out in like 10 minutes. Or 2 hours.
Yeah. Within a couple hours.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The standard joke is if you're going to the Comic-Con, leave now.
Yeah.
Whatever that is, that joke works all year round.
Yeah. I'll tell you one of my favorite moments. Was it in 84 or 86, the party for Jack?
That would have been 83.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
The first one. I know there was another one for him from later, but the big one that everybody planned, that Richard Howell and Carol Kalish took a big hand in planning, and they were there, and the Hawaiian band.
I'll tell you the straight part. We had this surprise party for Jack.
Yeah.
And this is Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And we rented a hotel ballroom.
Oh my gosh.
And
well, I guess
arranged for a cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started telling people, hey, give me money.
Yeah.
Just spread the word on. If you want to be at the party or what do you want to pay, just give Mark money. So people started coming up and handing me money. And so strangers were coming up to me all during the convention, just handing me fives and tens and 20s.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I just jammed it in my pocket. And at one point, Paul Levitz came up to me and Mike Hobson, who was the president, Paul was the president of DC and Mike was the publisher at Marvel. And they said, listen, we'll split the cost of the party. we'll pay for it. Okay. And I thought for a second and I said, no. You can give me a donation if you want, but this is the fans thanking Jack. You know, your money is good, but we're not going to stop collecting from fans. So at that time, the convention was more spread out, or at least my part of it was over. And I found myself down at the Holiday Inn down by the water. This was Friday night. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Len Wein and I, at 3 a.m., decided to walk back to our hotel, which meant we walked through the crummy part of San Diego, the tattoo parlor, sailor strip joint
area.
Hypnosex.
Yes, Hypnosex College, yes.
Hypnosex?
And we're walking through this. There was this place, the huge sign there that said, it was the College of Hypnosexism. We will teach you how to hypnotize women into taking their clothes off for you. This was like next to a massage parlor or a strip joint.
I thought you went in there and they like hit you over the head and you didn't remember if you had had sex.
Yes, yeah.
But they took your money.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact name of the place. I'll have to get home and check my diploma. We're walking through this part of the town where you suddenly, you think, you know, you're going to get mugged any second. And I suddenly realized I had like $6,000 in cash on me in fives and tens. I just had in every pocket. I had all this cash.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, if we get mugged, this guy's going to think he won the lottery. and we got home. We got back to the hotel safely. And the next morning, I took it into a bank. Saturday morning, I just dumped the cash. I turned this into a money order for me.
Yeah.
So I think I had about $6,000.
Holy cow.
And people just given me. And we had this lovely party for Jack, a surprise party, and everybody had a good time. The thing that was interesting about it, and the thing that's interesting about the panels that I like at the convention, is they're not about commerce. Most of the panels at the Comic-Con, most of the panels at most conventions, not just Comic-Con in San Diego, are infomercials. Mm-hmm. Maybe very entertaining infomercials, but people are promoting their new book, their new movie, their new TV show.
That's right.
One of the reasons I do panels is because I'd like the convention to have some panels that are not about commercial. The cartoon voice panels I do every year, nobody's selling it. You know, the people on the panel will tell about their new show, but the panel is not about promoting product. The quick draw is not about promoting product. Sergio and I do one GRU panel, and it only appeals to people who are going to buy GRU anyway.
Right.
So.
And who wouldn't, because it's awesome.
So most of the panels I do are interviewing people who ought to be interviewed for historical records.
Like Stan Freberg, for example.
Stan Freberg was at the convention last year.
Yeah.
And I got him to come down there, and people were thrilled to meet him.
And he had a huge line. He was down at Artist's Alley, too, for a while.
Yeah, wasn't he? Yeah, and it was great. He's been there 2 years. I don't think he's coming this year, but... one of the great things about the convention is everybody, if they want to, if you plan a little bit, you can come away thinking, I met this person. I got to meet, you know, there are so many people, you know, there are people who come up to me at the convention now and they want to shake my hand because they got into this too late to meet Jack Kirby. So shaking my hand is the closest they can come to shaking Jack's because my hand shook Jack's.
Yeah.
And so it's very wonderful that you can go home having made some contact with somebody that you always wanted to meet, or somebody you admired, someone who inspired you, and you can, there's an exchange there. You can buy a photo of them, and they can, you can tell them what your work means to me, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I remember once, kind of screwing up my courage to go say hi to Ray Bradbury, you know, because I, you know, love his writing, and he was very nice. And it turns out he was with a young man who was on a walker and kind of helping him out, and the guy knew who I was, and then made this glowing introduction between me and Ray, and we were walking along talking for 20 minutes about Homecoming, which is my favorite story.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But the story
getting
was
all
like
clumped.
What?
Yeah,
getting all
sweet.
Clumped.
Well,
obviously,
I can't even read that
that's
story.
Cool.
What?
Yeah.
I said it means a lot to you. That's cool.
Well, that's a story that always meant a lot to me. But but for some reason, I wasn't bawling at the time. I just had a nice conversation with him about that story, and he said, oh, I'm writing a bunch of new stories about those characters. And then later that year, he sent me a nice letter, and he had drawn monsters all over the front of the envelope. And,
awesome.
It was just great.
Yeah. For several years, the convention said to me, would you like to interview Ray Bradbury? And I went, yeah, I think I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
And then that panel expanded, because you had other writers in it too later, yeah.
Well, we 1 year we had Forry Ackerman and Julia Schwartz on the panel. And it was kind of sad, and or funny in a way. We had, there were at that time six ballrooms upstairs at the convention. five of which had wheelchair lifts to the stage, one did not. Oh. Guess which room I had the year I had three guys in wheelchairs. So we had Forey, and we had Julie, and we had Ray. And before the, you know, Forey was Bradbury's friend for years, and Julie was his first agent, Bradbury's first agent.
Yeah.
And we had Ray Bradbury. So before the panel starts, Julie comes up to me and he says, "Now ask me what secret I know about Ray Bradbury that nobody else knows, and ask me about what it was like to sell Ray's first story, and ask me about what Ray did when he got his first award." And, you know, okay, fine, thank you. So we start the panel off, and I say to Julie Schwartz, "Well, tell us what Ray Bradbury's place in science fiction is." And Forey says, "Well, Ray was very important." "Okay, thank you. Julie, tell us what it was like when you sold Ray's first story." Julie kind of nods and goes, "You have to get back to me on that, Mark." What? So then I ask Ray a question, and Ray gives a fabulous 5-minute answer that's just wonderful, and he's got the audience engrossed. One of the greatest public speakers in the world. And the audience loves it. And so he finished that. I go back to Forey and said, "So Forey, what was it like at the first you attended the first science fiction convention ever with Ray? Tell us what that was like." He goes, "Very exciting." "Okay, Julie, all right. Julie, tell us, I bet you know one secret that you only know about Ray Bradbury that nobody else knows. Tell us what that secret is." And Julie looks at me and goes, "What would that be, Mark?"
"Oh, jeez."
"Okay, Ray." "Tell us, I asked Ray a question. He gave a wonderful 7-minute answer." That was the year Julie Schwartz, you know, everybody knows Julie Schwartz was editor of DC for years and years. Mm-hmm. And Julie would come out to the convention almost every year. And the last couple of years, Julie would nag me to death to get him on the guest list of the convention. He wanted the convention to pay his way. and I'd have to get the convention, go to him, and say, "Come on, bring him out for another year, pay his way." They go, "Okay, fine, they pay his way." So one year I got the convention to bring him out. And I was nagging them. And they go, "Okay, we'll bring him out." And then about 2 weeks before the convention, Julie calls me and says, "I can't come out."
Oh.
And I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "Well, my legs are bothering me. You know, that hall is so big, so much walking. I can't come out. I can't walk through that hall. I'm just having so much trouble with my legs." And I said, "Well, Julie, we'll get you a wheelchair. Come on out. We'll have people in wheelchairs." He said, "I'm not going to need a wheelchair. Wheelchairs are for old men." I said, "Julie, you're 88. You're an old man. Come on." "What is 88? Middle age? Come on, you're old." He said, "No, I don't want people to see me in a wheelchair. I don't want to." I said, "Come on, Julie, come out. You're going to have to, if you're not, you're going to tell me you're never going to come out again, because your legs aren't going to get probably that much better."
Mm-hmm.
"Okay? If you can't come out in a wheelchair, you can't ever come to the convention again. You love coming to the convention." He says, "I don't know, Mark." I said, "Hey, here's what I do. The convention has lovely volunteers who love to push people in wheelchairs. I will get you the woman with the largest breasts to push you in the wheelchair."
Yeah.
He thought for a second and said, "That might work."
So the entire convention,
I never saw him in the wheelchair. Twice, though, I saw him pushing the lady with the large breasts in the wheelchair.
He just used her as a woman.
That's right, yes. You know.
That's amazing.
So the convention people, staffers come up to me and they say, "You know, we decided to make Julie a permanent guest of honor. We're going to invite him out every year.
Wow.
And we're going to go tell, don't you tell him, we're going to tell him formally in a presentation in a little while." So I look down the hall and I see them 20 minutes later telling him, obviously the convention's there and they're giving him the news. "From now on, you're going to be a guest of the convention. We'll fly you out every year. We'll give you a suite because we honor you and we love you."
Aww.
So I see him, he sees me, he starts coming over to me. I go, he's so proud. He's going to thank me for my role in making that happen. And he's going to tell me all about it and things like that. And he comes up to me and says, "Mark, they're going to fly me out every year." And I said, "Yeah, that's great, Julie." He says, "Listen, you got to get them to fly me first class because I got a big problem with my legs. I can't fly coach." And that was the moment I decked him right there. Dropped him with one punch. And
ran him over in the wheelchair.
Right. Yeah, Jesus.
That's not the only time that you guys have been together and somebody got punched, hey? Didn't you punch somebody?
I punched Jack LaLanne. No, Jack LaLanne punched me one time.
Wow.
And Paul and I were having...
Yes.
It's not that interesting story. But
it's a pretty interesting story, Mark.
No, it was over at Musso Frank's.
Yes.
People are always getting beaten up at Musso Frank's.
That's right. Yes, yeah. Yeah, Jack LaLanne took a swing at me.
Yeah, but Paul said you took it like a man.
Yeah, playfully. I thought to myself, I just got punched by an 88-year-old man. Well, I think I could take him, you know? Yeah. he was about 4'11", you know, a little tiny guy in a jumpsuit doing jumping jacks in the middle of a restaurant, you know. Yeah. What are you gonna do? So
now you've had an opportunity, and we kind of touched on Stan Freberg, to work with some really amazing people. Mm-hmm. And June Foray is one of them. June and you Foray helped write her book.
I helped Earl Kress and I helped June write her autobiography, which is still available from Amazon. And, mm-hmm. and I think if you write to JuneForay.com, I think we still got some copies for sale there. Yeah.
Nice.
June is an amazing lady. I love the fact that, you know, everybody listening to this will understand this concept. I can remember being a kid at home watching Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons mm-hmm. and watching Huckleberry Hound. And then I can remember being an adult hanging out with Dawes Butler and June Foray and Stan Freberg and Jay Ward and Bill Scott and people like that. And it's amazing when you can place yourself between those two things. When I was a kid, I bought a record that changed my life, which came out 50 years ago this month, called Stan Freberg Presents the United States of America.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the best comedy record ever done.
Yes.
I bought it at a record shop on Westwood Boulevard on the site where Junior's Delicatessen now stands.
Okay.
I bought this record. It was volume one. And I kept going back every week saying, is volume two out yet? Is volume two out yet? Little realizing that I have to wait 33 years and co-produce the damn thing. And there I was in the recording session for Stan Freberg Presents the United States of America, Volume 2.
Wow.
Working with him and helping him cast it and such. And I just am so amazed by that. And you can place yourself in both places. I can remember being the kid watching the Dick Van Dyke Show being filmed. And I got to be with Mr. Van Dyke last week. And I just showed you a photo of us and things mm-hmm. like that. And I'm very conscious of that. I'm very conscious. Here's one of those moments. The very first time Hanna-Barbera put any of their cartoons out on videotape, and this was beta,
before
VHS, uh-huh. I was hired to make the selections. And I did it from memory. I remember different cartoons. I said, get me this Huckleberry Hound, and that Mr. Jinx, and that Yogi Bear, and such. So they brought them in. They brought in 60 millimeter prints of them, and I went down to the basement of Hanna-Barbera and watched them on the Moviola down there to just refresh my memory, make sure they were as good as I remembered. And people would come by and they'd say, what are you doing? And I'd say, I'm working. I'm getting paid to watch Huckleberry Hound cartoons.
That is the best.
I've turned it
into
a profession. Don Messick, the voice of Boo Boo and Ranger Smith, came by and he said,
Scooby-Doo,
he heard his voice, Scooby-Doo,
yeah.
and Papa Smurf and hundreds of other characters came by and he heard his voice coming out of this thing and he poked his head in it and he said, hey, that's one of my cartoons there. I go, yes. And I watched this cartoon when I was 9 and I'm putting it on a videotape, damn it.
So can you tell us more about your Hanna-Barbera days?
I worked for Hanna-Barbera for a number of years. The first thing I did for them was a live-action pilot. The very first thing I ever did in television live-action, my then-partner Dennis Palumbo and I sold a idea for a brand new situation primetime comedy to the Hanna-Barbera live action department, which existed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they sold it to CBS and it never got filmed, it never got done, but it was a strange thing. We pitched them this show. We pitched it to the executives at CBS when I was, 24 years old, whatever it was. And they said, we love this idea. Unfortunately, it conflicts with another idea we just bought. We just commissioned a pilot for another idea, and we really can't commission two pilots for the same idea. But we think the other one isn't going to sell, so we'll option your idea, and once we drop the other one, we'll make your pilot. So they optioned our idea, and then they decided to put the other show on the air. Uh-huh. And then they said, it's probably not going to last very long, so once it goes off the air, we'll develop your pilot. And the other show was called Alice, and it was on for 9 years.
Man.
By the time it went off, they forgot about us.
Gee.
But in the meantime, the fact that we'd sold a series to CBS got us agents and offers and all sorts of things. Anyway, but the years later, after Dennis and I broke up, I teamed up for a time with a lady named Marion Freeman. His comedy sitcom. I was still a sitcom writer. Sitcom writers came in pairs then. And Marion Freeman had just broken up with her partner, a lady named Dawn Aldridge. Dawn and Marion together had done the pilot for Love Boat.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis and I had written some Love Boat. And then when Dawn and Marion, we all had the same agent, so they just, you know, when I broke with Dennis, our agent said, hey, you want to work right with Marion? Because she needs a partner. So we wrote a couple of shows. Yeah. And Hanna-Barbera hired us to write a live-action sitcom about three girls who live at the beach, wear string bikinis, have a rock group, and get into trouble.
You poor thing.
And we did this pilot. We cast it. Oh, and that was a hardship. Boy, I had to go in every day and sit there and watch women take their clothes off.
And cast a pretty well-known actress in that, didn't
we
you?
We cast a woman there, the most talented actress who came in, we cast, and the director, who was not very good, insisted on two of the girls, but I insisted on one of them. And the one I insisted on is now known under the name of Rita Wilson.
Oh.
And this was long before she ever met Tom Hanks or any of those people.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I ran into her a couple months ago, and I gave her a copy of the DVD. I transferred the show to DVD, and she was like, oh, God, I want to see it again. No, I don't want to see it again. Yeah. No, I want to see it again. But while I was doing that show, I met Joe Barbera, and I spent a year trying to disabuse him of the idea that I was a live-action writer. Because back then there was a belief that if you were live action, you couldn't write animation.
You don't cross the streams,
and,
right? Like
and I was simultaneously running the Hanna-Barbera comic book department in my spare time. So I'm writing the Scooby-Doo comic book, but when I said to Joe Barbera, hey, I'd like to write the Scooby-Doo show, he'd say, no, you live action writers don't understand animation writing.
Geez.
So they kept offering me live action projects, and they wouldn't give me animation writing to do. So I was running the Hanna-Barbera comic department, and I ended up writing cartoons for other studios first. And then finally, Mr. Barbera hired me, and I wrote Richie Rich and the Yogi Bear special, and I wrote the Trollkins, and I wrote a bunch of pilots that didn't sell, and I wrote, Scooby-Doo, I wrote the very first episode that had Scrappy doing it.
I was going to say, next question
did
for you.
Did you create him, or did
no,
you?
No.
Somebody came to you and said, make a Scrappy.
Somebody else, they developed this character. I had, for a long time, my function in the animation business was the phrase, everybody else in the building has had a shot at this, so we thought we'd give it to you.
Oh.
And I was like the fourth writer on the Yogi Bear Christmas special I did. I was the fifth writer on Scrappy-Doo.
Why didn't they just bring it to you first?
Because that would have...
Made sense?
Well, you know, one of the things that happens in this business all the time is that somebody comes to you and they say, look, we hired a really big-name writer and he bombed out.
Uh-huh.
We'd like you to write this, but we can't pay you very much because we spent so much money on him. And then I say, oh, because you hired the wrong guy, I'm supposed to take less?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened in the case of Scrappy-Doo was that I was not on staff at Hanna-Barbera. I was a freelance. Even though when I was story editing Richie Rich, I was a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to use staff people whenever possible. So all the staff guys that had a shot at the Scrappy-Doo pilot, it hadn't gone. And ABC said... well, maybe Evanier can save it. And so they hired me for that reason.
You're that guy.
Well, yeah, I'm that
That's
guy.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But I did a lot of that. Mm-hmm. One time, CBS called me up to write a pilot, and they said, we really need this pilot. We need it right away. And I said, well, can I have next week to finish it? And they said, Mark, if we had till next week, we would have called you next week.
Oh.
And so I wrote the pilot for Dungeons and Dragons in one day.
Oh my god!
Day and a half.
Nice.
It was 1 week when I wrote the pilot for The Littles and the Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, wow.
The same week, and sold both of them. I took my name off The Littles.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I like The Littles.
Yes, well.
You're like,
I was a kid then, I gotta say.
In the 11th hour, who does the job that they should have hired you to do like a month before.
Well, but the thing is, they wouldn't have liked it a month before.
Mm.
Sometimes, you at the last minute, they like it because it's easier at that point to like it than to not like it.
Yeah, there is that.
So,
But they also know that you're the right guy for the job.
Well, sometimes, occasionally. I've been replaced on things too. You know, there's,
well, everybody does. That's just the way it goes.
I have a weird question about Doss Butler.
Sure.
I've seen some pictures of him, like back in the early days of HB, posing with these two gorgeous puppets of Huck and Yogi.
Yeah.
Were those ever mass-produced, or
no,
were these made especially?
He had puppets made for personal appearances.
Oh, I see.
He had these wonderful little puppets that his wife Myrtis now has. That he would take when he went to schools or things like that. He had
puppets. Like Clarence Nash had the Donald Duck
That's
puppet.
Right, yeah. Oh. Dawes was a lovely entertainer, a wonderful man.
Yeah.
We miss him dearly. There's another guy who I just couldn't believe I became friends with. I had Dawes on my answering machine for years.
Oh, I remember that.
Howdy, yeah. And friends would leave messages. They'd say, Evanier, that doesn't sound anything like you. What a lame impression you did.
Unbelievable.
I think I only met him like once or twice. Once over at Gordon Kent's house. He had a party and Dawes mm-hmm. was there. And he was like this big. He was like the king of the leprechauns sitting in a chair yeah. like this holding court. And it was yeah. such a thrill to meet him.
Most of your great cartoon voice actors were short. Mm-hmm. Mel Blanc was short. June Foray is short.
She's yeah. tiny.
Dick Beals is very short.
Yeah.
June needs a ladder to get up on a barstool.
Yeah. 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 Imagine it's because the Hollywood casting system didn't like the idea of the short people. They thought taller people would be better actors.
My guess is that sometimes if you're short, you have to develop a big voice to be yeah. heard in the world.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A lot of them were very funny people, and you know,
yeah.
I think most of those people would have been like giving it a shot at stand-up comics if they had lived like, you know, 40 years later, you know, or started their career after that. They might have been, you know, like Borscht Belt comics or stand-up comedians or the first, you know, level of those guys. They were all tremendously funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we should wrap this up, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, we need to have you back for a part two. Like a part four, a part five, three. Six.
Yes. Yeah.
Part
three, six. I've lost track.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to get another slice of pizza if you do.
Yeah.
Well,
you got a week?
I guess June is Evanier month. We'll just go all month.
Yeah. All right. Oh, Mark, I can't thank you enough.
Glad yeah. it's fun.
Oh my gosh, you're so fast. Will you come back? Do you promise?
I will come back, certainly.
Oh, great. I would love to have you back.
And you were great on that Garfield we recorded last couple weeks ago.
Oh, yes. <I'm sorry. laughs> Well, that's right.
Yes.
When we started this, it was the next Tuesday.
That's
so
right,
we're...
yes.
Yeah, wow, thanks.
So wonderful.
That was really fun.
Yeah, well, the engineer screwed up that whole hour we lost. That was
of course, sorry. Of course, I know.
This has been another episode of RadioRashi.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, let us know. You can leave comments and reviews on iTunes or directly on RadioRashi.com. We're also now on social network sites like Twitter and Facebook. Leave us questions or just like us. And don't forget, tell your friends.